Hi, Jim Hoffman here from EMS Office Hours, and I want to thank you for taking a quick 20-30 minutes or so to join me and discuss some EMS topics. Of course, I always encourage you to send me your ideas and your comments on the topics on EMS that you want to discuss and you want to hear talked about on this podcast. Again, we're continuing with the new format here at EMS Office Hours with these pre-recorded sessions, and we will be having some live sessions coming up shortly, as well as some guests coming on also to join in the conversation. So be sure to sign up on the EMS Office Hours website for updates, and even go ahead and join the Office Hours podcast over in iTunes as well. All those links are right below the show notes here. And of course, you can also find us at the ProMed Network as well. So, requesting no license sirens. Have you ever had that when you're going to a call? You get assigned to a call. It could be anything, everything from a diff breather to an abdominal pain and something like that. And the last thing the dispatcher tells you is the caller requests no lights and sirens upon arrival. So what do you start doing? Well, you start kind of maybe thinking to yourself that, you know, how much of an emergency is this really if they're not even requesting us to have our lights and sirens on? I mean, they called 911. It's an ambulance. You know, the fact that it's an ambulance means it comes with lights and sirens. You know, what makes it, you know, so non-emergent that they still feel that you should call 911 for the care, yet they're requesting no lights and sirens? And more importantly, should we actually comply with that when we're responding to the call? I mean, how much liability is that putting us as providers on, and the agencies that we're working for, things like that, by not responding lights and sirens to calls? You know, I mean, we are a customer service type of an industry where we have to kind of, you know, think about the customer, which in this case is the patient or the family members. But at the same time, we have to think about what could be going on at the scene. A lot of times we're not really aware what's happening on scene until we get there. So someone's take of it being not so much of an emergency and requesting no lights and sirens, it might turn out that the patient actually does need us there a few minutes earlier than just kind of cruising there with no lights and sirens. And by, you know, going lights and sirens, getting us there a little faster, getting the treatment to the patient that they need. Now, of course, depending upon where you work, that might not be that much of an issue if you're working in areas where your response times aren't all that long and your area isn't all that large. But in some situations where you're working in areas that are very large, where, you know, you've got a long response time to the location or to the person's home, you know, going lights and sirens can, you know, give you a few extra moments. Now, of course, there's been some studies done, some information out there regarding going lights and sirens versus not lights and sirens, and how much faster we actually want to do get into the call. And it's really only winds up being only a few minutes. But still, at the same time, I'm thinking more of the lines, not necessarily the differences between the actual minutes that it's taking us to get there, or even safety issues as far as driving lights and sirens or not lights and sirens, kind of like another argument or another podcast for that. I'm thinking along the lines of, you know, if the caller is saying not to use lights and sirens, is it really an emergency? How much of an emergency or how much of a need for calling 911 do they actually have if they be able to go ahead and say, you know, don't respond lights and sirens? Now, the other thing to quickly mention too is, how do these callers know to even ask that that's even an option for them to request no lights and sirens upon arrival? You know, I sit there and I wonder, you know, I'm sure the dispatchers aren't saying, well, would you like lights and sirens with that, as if they're at McDonald's asking for apple pies. So I'm wondering where the patients and the families and whatnot get the information or get the idea to request not to have lights and sirens. I guess it's kind of easy to think about and easy to just say, oh, please, you know, can you ask them not to use their lights and sirens when they get here? A lot of times that's due because they're kind of embarrassed of having an ambulance at the home. They don't want their neighbors knowing what's going on. You know, maybe live on a very quiet street. They don't want to wake up neighbors in the middle of the night. There's been situations that I've been in where I've been asked not to use lights and sirens because I've responding to a school, and they don't want to disrupt classes, you know, in a school, and they'll ask that. So a lot of times what I'll wind up doing is I will respond lights and sirens to the scene, but then when I get about a block away or so, I'll go ahead and shut the lights off and shut the sirens off, and then respond in without them on to, you know, respect the patient's wishes, respect the caller's wishes, going to the call. But my main thing is, you know, just how much of an emergency is it if they're able to go ahead and say, don't put lights and sirens on, and in addition, how do they actually even know that that's an option for them to request that when they call 911? 911 usually means you're going to get lights and sirens, you're going to get a multiple response between ambulances, maybe fire department, maybe police department coming to your home or location. So, you know, how can you expect all these agencies not to do that? Why would that even be an option for them to even request that to begin with? So I'm wondering what you would do in this case. Would you comply with the caller's request? Do you have any kind of policies in place when a caller requests that? You know, do you comply with it according to local policies? Do you use your judgment according to the call type? Do you use your judgment according to the distance to the call? I'm wondering how you handle that and what your thoughts are when it comes to that type of request of no lights and sirens upon arrival to the call scene. So be sure to post your comments below. Let me know what you think when it comes to that type of request when you're working a 911 agency. Okay, today I couldn't find a product that I wanted to kind of point out today, but I do want to go ahead and mention a product that I have myself over at the EMS Professional at EMS-Safety.com. It's called the EMS Quick Study Guide, and this is a publication that I had designed, and it's really for students and refreshing EMTs and paramedics that are taking state and national exams. And this is available in both a digital format and in a physical format, you know, a spiral-bound book. It's about 120 pages. And what it's meant to be, it's actually meant to be the meat and potatoes, pretty much, of an EMS course. And it's actually the perfect thing to use to go ahead and review before an exam, or even as a quick overview for terms or subjects that you might be having some troubles with. So it's not like a gigantic study resource, but what it really is more of a quick review of all the meat and potatoes you're going to see on pretty much any exam. So it gives you the one-stop resource on a lot of the hot topics you're going to see on state and national exams. So if you ever really wanted just the basics that's going to be on the exam without having to skim through like 500 pages of a textbook, you know, this type of a study guide might actually be what you're looking for. You know, it's got the foundations of EMS, A&P, major body systems, organ systems, covering all subjects, you know, from poisoning to cardiovascular, pediatrics, communications. It has pathology in there, signs and symptoms, patient presentations. Plus, it has, you know, some treatment modalities in there, you know, general treatment modalities, and pretty much anything in between. So it's, you know, all crammed into 120 pages as a really great review to look at just before you go into that exam. So you're going to get the best parts of your textbook in kind of one little publication. So, you know, it doesn't just give you that basic overview. It's really designed to cover the major parts of what, again, a state and national exam are going to actually be testing on. So this way, it's going to help you really pass in that first try. So I think this is a really powerful guide. You know, it even covers things like history taking, the physical exams, and even patient assessment altogether. So again, it's not a complete EMS study resource, but it's definitely one of the most valuable publications that you can actually have in your EMS library. So go check it out. I'll put a link below the podcast here to go check that out. Again, it's available in the digital and spiral bound format. The great guide to have as part of your EMS library to review when it comes to any kind of quick test coming up or recertification stuff, and really kind of get your mind thinking on stuff that you might even be weak on. You know, if you're finding issues with a certain part of this guide that you're really not clicking, it might go ahead and kind of trigger you to go to the bigger textbook and really drill down and get a firmer understanding of that content. So, you know, again, great for new students, and it's also perfect for refreshing, you know, EMS pros as well. So go check that out. Again, I'll put the link below, and also go ahead and put a little graphic down there too. You can take a quick picture of it also. So go check that out. It's the EMS Quick Study Guide. It's one of my favorite products that I like to offer out there, and probably one of the more popular ones over at the EMS Professional as well. Okay, want to talk really quick, and I'm not going to go too much into this. I know I mentioned this before on another couple of the podcasts or some Monday Minutes that I've done, but you know, I was actually sitting down with a coworker the other day, and we're looking at some of the protocols that we have, and they're 2010 protocols, and he was having some issues and some confusion he felt with reading one of the particular protocol with the VTAC, Pulse's VTAC and VFib protocol, where talk about giving lidocaine if the patient converted, giving a lidocaine bolus and lidocaine drip, you know, to the patient. You know, lidocaine is a little controversial, where a lot of people feel it doesn't do anything. No great studies out there that show or prove that it actually does anything in relation to even a placebo-type drug, as opposed to just giving good CPR to a patient. So I wonder, you know, thinking about the protocols and thinking about these guidelines and looking at some of the the good long you know, the upcoming guidelines for American Heart Association that are you know, changing, coming up, you know, I start to wonder, like, why can't more agencies really get on board with what the American Heart Association is suggesting, really get in sync with what they want to do as far as changes from everything from the compression ratio to the drugs that are being given. You know, why is it that 2010 protocols in my region are still pushing lidocaine over amiodarone and kind of giving amiodarone as a suggestion that if you have it in your box that you can use that as an alternative to lidocaine? You know, and meanwhile, other regions and other protocols that I've read and I've looked upon, also, you know, they show lidocaine being taken out of the protocols altogether. You know, kind of going in sync with what the American Heart Association and a lot of research has shown, that it's not really that valuable of a drug to use as an antiarrhythmic in cardiac arrest patients. You know, what is it that we can do, do you think, to kind of get agencies and regions on board with the American Heart Association changes a little quicker? I mean, let me give you a suggestion, an example here, too, is recently, you know, when the American Heart Association changed their guidelines last time, by the time one region that I'm aware of, you know, by the time they went ahead and updated their protocols to reflect those changes, got them all printed out, all online, uploaded, you know, printed for agencies on CD-ROMs, whatever. By the time they did all that, American Heart Association went and changed the guidelines again. So now they just did it, and then the following year, the American Heart Association changed again. So now all that money that was put out there, all that you know, resources and now training done for the upgrades for that region, now it's all for naught because now the American Heart Association came out with new changes. So what can we do to really get, you know, more agencies and more regional systems, you know, get on board and in sync with American Heart Association? I mean, maybe American Heart Association should do something like, you know, releasing potential updates and changes to these regional authorities, so that they can really begin to implement them before they're live. You know, give these regional authorities and the individual agencies a chance to start implementing and going through with their medical directors and medical advisories to get these changes in place. So when the American Heart Association actually releases them to the general public, and to healthcare providers as a whole, that they're already kind of in the loop, they're already not behind the eight ball, and they're ready to start going ahead and pumping these out. You know, you got to think about the things that they're doing every time they change. You know, people have to go through additional training, the updates, protocol adjustments, if you know, as needed as well, and then it has to be approved usually by medical directors and medical authorities and medical advisory within individual regions. You know, and then all the money, of course, again, for printing all this stuff out, all the money it costs for training and the updates and everything. You know, and then of course the time value as well. So maybe if American Heart Association kind of got people in the loop more with these changes, saying, okay, these are going to be the changes, are going to be effective this month and this year, you might want to start thinking about, you know, getting these into your protocols and getting ready to have your employees and your staff getting your providers and all trained and re-updated on the changes that we're proposing. And that might even give some an opportunity as well to get agencies and regions to give some input on the changes as well, as far as keeping things in there like lidocaine and all, as an option when, not a lot of research showing that it really does a lot for, cardiac arrest patients. So that's just my little quick little take on that, and I don't want to think that, that's the one-stop fix for this issue, but I think that maybe if more agencies as a whole were included in the updates and included in the potential changes that are going to be going on, that agencies and regions can get their people on board a lot faster and make the transition to these changes a lot smoother, and of course get us into the more appropriate patient care a lot faster as well. So just wondering what you think about that also. I mean, is your agency up to date now? Are they going to be implementing these new CPR and American Heart Association guidelines immediately? Is it going to take some time to get protocols changed and medical directors on board and people retrained? How quickly do you think your agency and your region is going to be up to speed with these proposed changes? Comment below. Let me know what you think and how fast you think your agency is going to be getting on board with these, or even if your agency is already on board. I've spoken to a few people whose agencies are already on board with a lot of these new changes. We kind of got some medical directors that are very EMS friendly and really into EMS and getting these changes on board and getting the changes available to EMS a lot faster as well. So comment below. Let me know what you think when it comes to this type of a situation and what you think we could do to really get regional authorities and regional EMS authorities on board a little faster when it comes to that. That kind of brings me to my resources for today. And going along this whole line of the American Heart Association changes and all, there's a blogger out there called Rogue Medic. He's at roguemedic.com. And he's got some great blog posts on this, several blog posts regarding these American Heart Association changes, his take on it, and a lot of the posts he has, regarding the changes, and he really covers some great aspects into the research and the changes, and the apparent, desire for a lot of places to just be able to, keep the status quo on the way things go, and the American Heart Association to even attempt to keep things status quo just to kind of allow providers to do something, by keeping things like lidocaine in the protocol. Go check that out. Some really great posts there, some great research references there as well. Worth a read. Got several posts on it. Right now he's doing some amiodarone, information on the American Heart Association treatments and changes. He did some stuff on lidocaine, and on top of that, a lot of other great posts there as well. So I'm putting a link below for the lidocaine one. I think you're going to find pretty interesting. Again, it's at roguemedic.com. Some great posts there for that. Another thing you can do as well regarding this implementation, and I listened to a podcast over at EMS Garage, and they did a podcast on their take. They had a group of people there, and it was their take on why there's always a little bit of a delay and change when it comes to implementation of these new types of changes, and why they feel there's always a delay when it comes to getting these changes and stuff on board a little faster and getting providers in sync with American Heart Association and agencies in sync with these changes. So go listen to that podcast as well. Again, of course, put the link below there as well. Go check that out and listen to that podcast. I hope you can get something out of these podcasts that I'm doing here. Just trying to get some information out, trying to stimulate some thought process on your end, get your conversation going, whether it's within the blog post here, blog posts or other podcasters and other blogs out there, or even if it's just between you and your partner and some of your EMS peers, to kind of get the dialogue going into the things that are really affecting us in EMS and the things that you think that we can do to maybe change things for the better, even if it's just one protocol at a time, one piece of equipment at a time, getting these changes done and making EMS in the end better for everybody, even if it's just in your little region. What do you think that we can do to get stuff going that maybe other regions will start picking up on, other agencies will pick up on, and eventually get the whole nation on one page, be one big EMS agency, instead of having all different agencies doing things different ways and not really on board with each other when it comes to our end goals and what we want as a profession. So, again, just about out of time, so I just want to, again, thank you for listening to me today. You know, I love doing these EMS office hours, and, you know, thanks for taking a listen. Remember, I'm here and dedicated, again, to you, EMS professional, and I want to talk about what you're thinking regarding the EMS industry, so be sure to comment on the show below in the blog post. Send me your ideas, even if you want, directly. My email address is jhoffman@ems-safety.com. I read all my emails. I respond to all my emails. Let me know your industry concerns, even if you have testing questions, or even a recent call that you had you thought was interesting. I'll be sure to try to fit it in an upcoming episode and even share your thoughts with the EMS community that listens to EMS Office Hours. Thanks again for joining me, guys. This is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours, and as always, stay safe.